Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymere Church of Christ.
Thank you guys for coming here. And if that's for me, I'm busy. If it's the pizza guy, tell him to come in the front. I appreciate the invitation to be here and appreciate the fact that you came out on a beautiful Saturday to talk about things that are of importance. I started in youth ministry in the spring of 1980. And so I've been working in some capacity with kids and youth, and then realized I had been trained to preach, not to minister. And so I went back and started working on some counseling stuff so that I could be a better minister and deal with kids and families and marriages and stuff in crisis. And then it was kind of our vision laid on our hearts to be self-supported ministers. And so we went into private practice and told the church they could do cool stuff with our salary, that we would be generating a salary. And so I've been kind of a self-supported family minister since the early part of 98. And so I still am active with a church. I'm now the intergenerational minister. Well, I think that means you're too old to work with the kids and too young to work with the senior citizens, or they just wanted to see if they could get a name that was longer than I am. And so that's what they call me. We call it the Mickey Mouse approach. Sometimes you have a youth group, an adult group, and a seniors group, and the church looks like Mickey Mouse. You have these three distinct circles, and we're trying to push those circles together. And that's what intergenerational ministry does. We're not inventing anything. We're just modifying some of the stuff that's already there. We have one adult daughter. She is the alumni director at a small school, and she has a photography business. I recognize that if you only have one child, it's like having a glorified pet. And so I realize that. So my parenting expertise, if I have any, actually comes more from my father than it does anything else, because he's the guy who dealt with me and with a lot of wisdom and gentleness and stuff. And through the years, you know, been able to be experienced with lots of different things with kids, especially as a youth minister. You get to see generations of kids go through the same thing. You know, your first year as a youth minister, you have a sermon that says 10 commandments for parents. Well, when you're 25 and have a toddler, you do a sermon called 5 suggestions for parents. When you're 35 and have a teenager, you go, hey, let's hire some guy to come in with a briefcase and talk about parenting, because it's different to talk about it when they're not at your house and not there. When I went into private practice, I thought that if I wasn't going to wear the title youth minister anymore, I might not be in the club, and then nobody would want to know my opinions on stuff. And so I put together some ideas or some essays on what I had tried to do as a full-time in-the-office church guy. A lot of the stuff I did was based on a book by Stephen Glenn. Stephen Glenn wrote a book, Raising Self-Reliant Children in a Self-Indulgent World. And I wrote Dr. Glenn and said, I've been using your ideas for a number of years to foster an idea in youth ministry called Spiritually Self-Reliant Kids. And I said, I'm going to write some of these things down, and I would like permission to use your research and use your terms and talk about some of the things you've done, but just tweak it to a church environment. And Dr. Glenn was super, super nice, sent me a letter, said, as long as you tell them where you got the original stuff, we're cool. And so that's kind of how my view of youth ministry got, started, was the idea of raising spiritually self-reliant children. And it's our goal, if you'll notice, this is the non-traditional parenting passage rather than the Ephesians 5 passage or some of the stuff out of Proverbs. I like this. You are witnesses in God also how devoutly, justly, and blamelessly we behaved ourselves among you who believe. As you know, we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you, as a father does his own children, that you would walk worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. Paul said, if I fathered you, my goal as a father was to get you to walk worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. And if you get a Rhodes Scholar or an MIT doctorate or a kid who's a starting quarterback for a SEC Division I team, great. But if they don't walk according to the kingdom and glory of God, we failed as parents. And so along with the just how do you get them to do homework, how do you make them go to bed, how do you punish them when they break curfew, all that is in the background of getting kids to have a relationship with God and getting kids to go to heaven. And that's kind of the starting point. My premise of this is to help you be spiritual people and help you raise spiritual kids. Now, if you'll notice this, and I'm going to trip myself there, the New Century Version says, when we were with you, we lived holy and honest without fault. You know this is true, and you know that we treated you as a father treats his own children. We encouraged you, we urged you, and we insisted that you live good lives for God who calls you into his glory. And then I think the Contemporary English Version says, both you and God are witnesses that we were pure, honest, and innocent in our dealings with you as followers of the Lord. You also know that we did everything that parents would do for their children. We begged, we encouraged, we urged that each of you live in a way that would honor God. He is the one who chose you to share in his kingdom and glory. So when we look at those verses and those different translations, you're going to find out that there's some parental functions. There's some things to be, and then there's some things to do. The things that parents are to be: devout or pure, holy, just, honest, blameless, or innocent. Sometimes even without fault. Now, these words don't mean that you've got to be perfect. They're talking about being consistent. Children do not tolerate inconsistencies. In George Barner's research on kids who stay faithful to the church after their teenage years, he says there's three factors: what happens at home, what happens at church, and how influenced the child is by popular culture. You can manipulate two of those three things. You can change what happens at home. You can change what happens at church. You really don't have a lot of influence as to how a kid buys in or does not buy into popular culture. The dynamic of what happens at home is not about dad to son or dad to daughter. The dynamic at home is not about what happens between mom and son and mom and daughter. The dynamic at home is what happens between mom and dad. And if you're hearing these messages at church, and you're hearing about love and selflessness and honor and respect and submission, and mom and dad don't have a good relationship, kids pick up on that, and it sends a mixed message. In the psychology business, we call it cognitive dissonance. A child can actually handle this message. A child can have you say, you can go down there to that church and you can hang out with those people, but I'm not going with you. Ask any youth minister in the room, and we've all had success stories where a child came to church and had surrogate spiritual parents. Had lots of kids come through our program, and their grandparents were the only spiritual people they knew, and they got to meet some other folks. Kids can handle that message. Kids can also handle this message. Hey, let's go to church together and let's worship and serve God. Kids do well with that. In fact, you're the primary influence on your children's spiritual development over anything else. You're the number one factor. So children can handle this and children can handle this. Children don't do very well with this in any way, shape, or form. They don't handle the inconsistency. So if our lives aren't together, if we don't have our act together and we're not devout, pure, holy, just, honest, innocent, fair, try to be consistent, then we create some potential problems already. In fact, there is a predictor of at-risk behavior, and this is spiritually at-risk behavior. At-risk behavior in the school is failure to graduate, use of marijuana, use of alcohol, promiscuity, vandalism, all those things. Spiritually at-risk behavior is them failing to develop a relationship with God. Maybe church attendance, maybe activity level with the congregation. There's a predictor of at-risk behavior. It's this question: do your parents profess things in public that they do not practice in private? If you ask a child that at any level, hey, do mom and dad say this in public but live this way in private, and you get an answer to the affirmative, that is a 95% predictor that those children will exhibit spiritually at-risk behavior. So when somebody comes in and says, hey, I don't know what happened, a lot of times the indicator is something's going on in the dynamic of the home that is not modeling devoutness, holiness, justness, blamelessness, or innocence. And so that's, now, this is a correlation, not a causation. Everybody understand the difference between correlation and causation? Okay, in Alabama, this means yes. This means no. This means you're not voting. Correlation means that you can associate that these things happen together, but just because one happens doesn't make the other happen. This is a correlation, not a causation. Do bad things happen when you walk under a ladder? Yes. Why? Stupidity, not bad luck, okay? But we've associated that walking under a ladder makes those things happen. No, people drop things off ladders. If you're under the ladder, you're more likely to get hurt. There's a correlation, not a causation. So when we talk about this kind of stuff, it's important that we're honest about it, that we do have some influence, and it's correlated to these things, not necessarily causative. So when we look at this stuff, the first thing we want to understand is that your parenting style has a lot to do with the development of your children. There's a test called the EPAC test. It's expectations of parenting dealing with autonomy and control. They gave this test to guys that were in prison. And basically the test comes out with you have one pole that is permissiveness, you have one that is strictness, you have one that is hostility, and you have one that is love. So that you can bisect that thing and quad it out. And so then you have a parenting style that deals with either autonomy or control. And so you give this test to these guys and you say, when you talk about your perceptions of how you were raised, some people feel like they were raised with hostile autonomy. I don't care what you do as long as you don't bother me. You may have gone to school and may know people like that, kids that don't have curfews. As long as you leave me alone, don't interfere with me, you go and do your thing. There are parents who raise their kids with hostile control. The old politically incorrect joke, what do you say to a kid with two black eyes? Nothing. You done told him twice, okay? You know, you're going to control that kid, and it's with the iron fist, and you're going to intimidate, and you're going to bully, and everything is about fear. Then you have those parents who have give their kids excessive autonomy because they love them too much to hurt their feelings. They love them too much to put any restraints on them. These are the hippies who had kids. You know, we just want you to be happy, honey. Just peace out, you know. And so their kids can do anything they want to, anytime they want to, as long as it's love and roses and unicorn glasses. And then you have those parents who, because of their love, have excessive control. Well, how dare that teacher give you a B-? I'll go down there and straighten her out right now. You let me talk to that basketball coach. You will be the forward. You're going to pitch for that baseball team. Let mommy write your Lads to Leader speech for you. You're going to sit here, and then they live their lives through their children being the best and the brightest because that's a reflection on themselves. These are the kids who kill themselves, by the way, because you can only have that kind of pressure that long. And at some point, they say, you know what? I'm number one at everything I do, and I'm still not happy. Bye. And they leave the planet. When you look at this chart, there's going to be a real interesting little slice of the pie. Keep your eye on the pie. Now, once they talked about, hey, if a person says, this is my, and sometimes perception is just that. It's the way a kid perceives things. You know, all adult acting out behavior is based on childhood trauma. The sticker is you don't get to choose what's traumatic for a child. I had literally, same week, two kids in my office. Kid sitting there in a little black chair in my office. He goes, man, I'm just miserable. My dad works at this huge company, and he's a CEO, and we have this timeshare down in Cancun, and every summer we go down there, and I can't stay at home and ride my bike around the neighborhood with my friends. On Thursday, had a kid sitting in the black chair. He goes, man, the only thing we do all summer is ride our bicycle around the neighborhood with our friends. I wished I could go somewhere. I said, let me make a phone call. I'll trade parents with y'all, and I'll be the greatest thing since sliced bread. You know, here's a kid who's got an exotic vacation. He would stay home and ride a bike. Here's a kid who rides a bike. Wish he could have an exotic vacation. So you don't really get to choose what's traumatic for a kid, okay? But so these parenting expectations, your child may say that mom and dad were evil. And it may or may not be an accurate perception, but if they plug you into these things, they started asking, if a child says I was parented with hostile autonomy or I was parented with hostile control, is there any way that we can use that as a predictor? Do these kind of parenting styles lend to certain kinds of behavior? And so what they did is they started asking about their behaviors, and once they started that, they were able to make some predictions. I think the worst prediction they had was 68%. If you shot dove with 68% accuracy, Benelli would sponsor you. They'd give you a shotgun every day to have you go out and demonstrate their product. So 68% is that's the worst they did. If somebody said, hey, I'm in this quadrant, they could predict. I told you where the hippies had kids. When kids were parented with that permissiveness love thing, those kids were predictable that they were the marijuana users. The folks with the hostile permissiveness use inhalants and hallucinogens. They escape the noise and they escape the drama. These kids over here used heroin because mom and dad were ogres and beasts, and they wanted that deep escapism. The guys down here in this lower quadrant, they would use alcohol, cocaine, and sedatives. Those kids got to be the best, got to be the brightest, got to be number one. And if you're not, then we failed as parents. And their perception of what their parents expected or wanted or pushed on them, the messages they heard at home, were correlated with these kind of behaviors. And this is without talking to the kids. And this is without talking to the parents. This is simply talking to the kids. Hey, tell us about your parenting when you grew up. How did your parents treat you? You deal with an addict, specifically at Bethesda Workshops. They deal with sex addicts. And you talk about, tell me about your mom, tell me about your dad. Tell me about your unwritten rules at home. And what was your role in that family? Because your role in the family fulfills that expectation of what you thought your parents were supposed to be. And you'll find out that a lot of these parenting styles get described there. Now remember the little piece of the pie I wanted you to focus on? Anytime anybody ended up in that slice of the pie, a balance between permissiveness and strictness with love, there was non-use. No drugs, no alcohol, no promiscuity, no joining of cults, no vandalism. There seems to be a balance between permissiveness and strictness. I've got limits, but you have responsibility. I have limits, but you're going to face some consequences. I want you to become a mature adult, and so you need to learn to do some things, and I love you, and I love you enough to discipline you. That sweet spot there is kind of the object of what we want to do as parenting. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up with the nurture, permissiveness and love, and admonition, warning, consequences, rules, boundaries, parameters. Bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Now I'll take a breath and see if you have to ask any questions about that. Na, 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 na. This is the way they perceived it, yes. Right, right, right. Right. And so, again, and that's correlation, not causation. But you start looking at your own parenting style and you think, you know, am I the guy who tends to be hostily strict? I'll make another one just like you, you know. Or are you that parent who's trying to live vicariously through your kids and you feel like you failed if they're not a quarterback? And there's a lot of kids who play baseball and hate it, but they don't tell their dad they don't want to play. And so it's learning that kids do math in weird ways. Kids come to conclusions that are not necessarily accurate. If you're from a divorced family, can you remember feeling like their divorce was your fault? I worked with a little six-year-old, angry, oh my goodness, hitting people, kicking the teacher, slapping folks, biting folks, spitting on folks. He and his dad were bush hogging a pasture and the tractor rolled over. His dad was pinned under the bush hog and died. And after several months of work, I discovered this little guy was angry at himself because he couldn't bicep curl a bush hog. 6 years old and thought he let his dad die because he couldn't lift the tractor. I took him down to the police gym. I volunteer as a chaplain and been with Huntsville SWAT for 23 years. Took him down to the police gym and said, let's ask these guys if they can bicep curl a tractor. Big muscled up monster looking meat eaters, and they couldn't. I said, well, you see if you can, you know, and finally got him to realize, hey, your dad dying under that tractor wasn't your fault. But he'd done the math at 6 years old. I need to be Superman, my dad be alive. Well, kids come to some weird, weird conclusion. Sit down with a kid who's 16, whose dad's never had anything to do with him, and they're in trouble, they're acting out, and I don't do the best therapy techniques in the world, but I'm kind of a upfront guy. So I have some 16-year-old, and I go, okay, bottom line is mom tells me dad's been absent from your life about 7 years. He says he's coming to your birthday party. He doesn't come. He says you're going on vacation with him. You don't go. Let's just cut to the chase. What's wrong with you that your dad won't have anything to do with you? You know, 95% of those kids go, I don't know. When the answer should be, nothing. My dad's a jerk. But these kids believe it's their fault. And when you get them to realize, you know what? If you could cause your dad to leave you, you could cause your dad to be back. Since dad ain't here, you ain't driving the bus. Kids draw conclusions that are not accurate. But sometimes they draw these conclusions with a little help from us. And so just analyze, what message am I sending my child? An interesting thing to do as a youth minister is to sit your kids in one room and your parents in another room and ask the parents, what are the three main messages you send your children? And of course, it's in a church setting, so they'll go, love God, love each other, and be successful. And then you ask the kids what the three main messages you hear at home. Make good grades, be a super athlete, and cut your hair, or whatever. And the messages the kids say they're hearing at home and the messages mom and dad say they're sending don't match. And this is what happens when that mismatch comes out and kids misperceive what we're trying to tell them. The functions of the parents, the things to be holy, devout, just, and blameless. The function of the parents, Paul said, we want you to encourage, and we comforted, and we urged you. Now that's basically going to be the three-part model for my youth ministry and for what I think parents should do. We encourage our kids. That's going to be basically stimulating them to do the things that they should do properly. Be good students, be good citizens, step outside their comfort zones, all kind of stuff. Comfort is responding to crisis intervention, whatever that happens to be, whether it's a divorce, death of a grandparent, failure at school, I broke up with my girlfriend, and then we're going to do urge, and urging is going to be talking about the discipline phase, which is what everybody comes to a parenting workshop about. When can we beat our kids? And so we'll get to that fun part later and talk about it, but we'll do it in sections, encourage, comfort, and urge. The reason we do the encourage, comfort, and urge is because of this. This is an inverse proportionate diagram. I really don't know what it means. It just sounds scientific. The inverse proportions, you notice the thick side over here matches the thin side over there, and the thin side matches the thick side. That makes it inverse proportionate. That side represents dependence. This side represents independence. So where your dependence is very, very large, your independence is very, very small. Where your dependence is very, very small, your independence is very, very large. Everybody see that? Okay, when you come to the planet at birth and you live all the way through adulthood, when you are born, you have 100% dependence. You can't do anything on your own. You have 0% independence. You can't roll over unless your parents flop you over. You don't control what goes in. And we feed them that green gooey stuff out of a jar, you don't control what goes out. Green gooey stuff on the other end. Those little girls come to church with those head tourniquets on and a flower bigger than their little faces. They don't like those. They don't want to wear those. If they had fine motor control, they'd take them off, but they can't. So they lay there and you think, look how pretty. She's like, this is killing my brain. And you're cutting the blood flow off to the prefrontal cortex. So when you're born, you have zero independence, you're 100% dependent, and as you progress to adulthood, at some point you and I should be taking a dirt nap. And we're not there to do anything for them or make them do anything. And so they will be 0% dependent, and they should have 100% independence. They should be on their own, doing all their own stuff. And just because we've got the chart on the board, that's an interesting section of that little diagram. Let's clean it up. That section right there where the independent and dependent sections are exactly the same, that's called a teenager. He's as much adult as he is kid. I want my own car. I want my own job. I want my own money so I can buy video games. And so he's got one foot in the adult world and one foot in the kid world. A 17-year-old, ask a 17-year-old, how many times you've been 17? The smart ones will go, once, okay? He's 17. He's as big as he's ever been. He's as mature as he's ever been. He's got all the experience he's ever had. He thinks he's arrived in the world because he's 17. I got a French fry underneath the seat of my truck that's 17. That's not a big deal for me, okay? But when you're 17, you're there. That's what makes teenagers so interesting, because they're adult children or they're child adults. They have all the things that they should have to be independent, but they can't. They can't even sign a contract. They're not 18 yet. So that's what makes working with teenagers really fun, interesting, and also a little bit challenging and frustrating. So, first parental function. As parents, we want to encourage our children. Sometimes that word is beg. Sometimes that word is plead. Sometimes that word is exhort. The Greek word that's used in Corinthians, parakaleo, is to call one to one side for aid. So I'm going to involve you in my life doing things. If you talk about Stephen Glenn, he has a thing he calls the Significant Seven. I'm an old Western movie fan. I would have named him the Magnificent Seven, but he did the Significant Seven. And in the Significant Seven, he says there are three perceptions and four skills. I'll list those. We're going to get to them in different sections. The three perceptions is I am capable, I am significant, and I can influence what happens to me. I'm capable, I'm significant, and I influence what happens to me. The four skills are intrapersonal, interpersonal, systemic, and judgmental skills. Systemic and judgmental. When you encourage children, you call them to your side for aid, you allow them to do some things, you fulfill those two significant perceptions. Number one, I'm capable, and number two, I'm significant. What that means is your children should be learning to do things for themselves. Contrary to the Harry Potter novels, there's no such thing as a house elf. When it gets done in a house, a human does it. The dishes, the laundry, the yard, brushing of teeth, making of beds, all kind of things. And our children should be encouraged to do some things for themselves. It's a disservice to your children if they leave your house and don't know how to do laundry and don't know how to cook. It's a disservice to your children if they can't change oil and change a tire on a car. It's a disservice to your kid if they can't figure out, you know what, I don't understand this homework, I've got to work it out for myself. If we're always doing it for them, what happens if you disappear? If they think that mom is just a glorified maitre d', how are they going to treat their wives? If they think the husband is just a glorified handyman, how are they going to treat their husbands? Teaching them to be well-rounded people, number one, you teach them they can do some stuff. And then self-esteem is built on competence, or confidence, and confidence is built on competence. The fact that I can do something makes me feel good about myself. Our society now teaches that kids should come from the factory with self-esteem. Not until you've done something. I don't think you feel that good about anything. You know, until you demonstrate that you're making a contribution to your household or to your society, I worry about this everybody gets a trophy mentality. There's no such thing as just a participation award. Now, when I start talking about athletics, and I'll chase a rabbit here, I believe in performance-based coaching, not outcome-based coaching. Outcome-based coaching is if we didn't win the ring, we didn't win the belt, we didn't win the trophy, we failed. Well, in athletics, there are some things you can't control. You may be a stellar team and get a screwy referee. You may be the best team that came out of Madison County but run into some of those schools in Vestavia Hills. You may be a very good tennis player and run into a guy who's a better tennis player. Well, that doesn't mean you failed. One of the disservices we do our children is we teach that winning and losing is the same as success and failure. And that's just not true. I remember the first one that was significant to me, the first national championship that the University of Alabama won. I remember them asking Mark Ingram a question, but I don't remember how he answered it. But I remember Colt McCoy got his shoulder hurt like the third or fourth play and lost the national championship. And I remember an interviewer sticking a mic in his face. You've just lost the national championship. How do you feel about that? That guy needs to be hit with a football helmet, by the way. But Colt McCoy said, well, you know, things just happen sometimes, and I trust in God that He has a path for my life. That's the loser of the national championship, not the winner. Winning and losing is not the same thing as success and failure. Don't ever get those two confused, especially when you're dealing with kids in athletics. Performance-based coaching talks about, did we learn a skill and did we improve on it? That's all that matters. Did I learn to dribble better? Did I learn to shoot better? Did I learn some self-control? Did I learn some discipline? Did I learn some endurance? Did I improve my cardiovascular skills? If you're participating in childhood athletics and you can answer yes to those things, then you're a successful athlete. And you never have a trophy, you never have a belt, you never have a ring, and it don't matter. But if the only time you're successful is when you win the thing, only one team every year is successful. And sometimes I'm capable. I'm terrible at basketball. Why? We didn't win the state championship. What did you learn? Teamwork? Did you learn some communication? Did you learn to keep playing when you were sick or hurt? Yeah. You learn some things that athletic is supposed to teach you. Athletics is not about winning. Athletics is about discipline. Everybody cool with that? So we start functioning with I'm capable, and teaching children that they're capable then teaches them that they're significant. In church work, one of the old statistics, and this is not a current statistic because I'm an old guy, but it used to be that we lost 75% of our kids between the ages of 13 and 23. Between the ages of 13 and 23, 75% of the kids leave the church. The second statistic was that in their mid-20s, 80% of the 75% come back to the church if they have one thing in common. As frequently as once a month, they did something at the church. That was, did you put visitors cards in the pews? Did you organize the songbooks? Did you come down here and help them cut the grass? Did you participate in men's work day on campus? Did you participate in the ladies' sewing circle? Did you write cards to the sick? If those children had some connection with the church that said, hey, I'm capable, there's something I can do here, and I'm significant, they need me to do it. Those kids came back to the church in their late 20s because of these two perceptions. Now, when we start parenting our kids, and we teach them that there are some things you can do around the house. You need to help mom with the dishes. And by the way, everything that you do that I don't have to do gives us all time to do something we all enjoy. If dad doesn't have to cut grass every Saturday, then y'all can all go to the park and play frisbee. If dad doesn't have to cut grass every Saturday, you can go fishing. If mom doesn't have to clean the dishes, then you could all go shopping. Whatever the deal is, but a lot of times we baby our children and they become consumers where everything is done for them, everything is provided for them, and we teach a generation of learned helplessness. So the first thing we do with our kids is encourage them. And I like the idea of encouragement is just, I mean, just basically making a play on words. You infuse courage to the kid. Now, how do you give a child courage? Well, if you're dealing with anxiety or treating a panic disorder or dealing with a phobia, how do you fix those? You treat them. You expose them to the thing they're afraid of. You know, we run a ropes course at home. We have a 55-foot swing. You hang on two cables. Your team pulls you in the air, and you let go of a thing, and you swing. It's built like a half pipe. The anchor point and the release point on most of those swings are not level, so you swing elliptically. Ours is built so that your release point and your anchor point is higher, and so you swing like you're in a big half pipe. You get negative air on both ends. There's just a minute where you go, I don't think that thing caught me. And you'll hook somebody up and they'll go, you know, I'm afraid of heights. I go, you won't be after this. And sure enough, they're pretty comfortable with the whole thing. That's what you do. You expose people. You give them courage by making them face some things they're uncomfortable with. When I was, I couldn't have been in the sixth grade. We lived at this old rental house out near Coleman Road near Anniston, Alabama. And it was like a long driveway. And it was this little hill with this block house. And the property sloped on both ends. And down here was a pine thicket. And on down here was a pine thicket. And there was just woods behind us. And it was like this little, just this bare moon station out there on this little piece of property. We had three dogs. And we kept them in the pine thicket. And my job was to water the dogs. I had to, you know, I'm a towering 5'4". I grew 4 inches in college. So in middle school and high school, I was the 4'11". And so if you've ever tried to carry a 5-gallon bucket full of water being 4'11", there's some mathematical issues that go with that. A gallon of water weighs 8 pounds. So, you know, 5 gallons times, you know. So I'm this little guy trying to carry this bucket. So my job was to water these dogs, and because it was such a hassle, I would often forget to water the dogs. So my dad would come in from work, and we'd be sitting there eating supper, and things would be just about done. He goes, "You water the dogs?" "No, sir." "Get to it." You walk out the door, pitch black dark. No street lights. All the way out there to those pines. And you get just a little bit of ambient light from the house. When you drop down that hill in those pines, it was dark. I mean, it was dark in the bottom of the devil's feet down there. It's unbelievable. And there's a pine tree monster. Pine tree monsters live in pine trees. Everybody knows that. And if you look at one, they'll eat you. And they have dinosaur vision. If you run, that just attracts them to you. So you go walking off down there with your water bucket, and you can't look in the trees. You just hear them moving around up there. You water the dogs, and then you have to walk back real slow, because if you run, they'll pick up the motion, and you're dead, and you feel them breathing on your neck. If you ever turn around, and you're done. So I'd go down there, you know, just, you know, and walk it out, and you hear the pine trees. You hear them moving those pine trees, man. There, and the place was loaded with them. And I'd walk down there, and I'd water those dogs, and I'd start back up that hill. And about the time my little head would peek over that hill, I'd see that old block house, white concrete blocks, yellow porch light. My dad's standing out there, and in those days, he still smoked. Pine tree monsters are frightened to death of my dad. If my dad's out there, they won't even get on the ground. And the minute I topped that hill and saw my dad, whew. Now he could have called me a coward. He could have called me a sissy. And he could have made fun of the fact that I was scared of the dark. He didn't. Now he knew I was scared of the dark, and he could have gone in there and watered the dogs for me. But he didn't. He stood out there on the porch. "You do your job. If there is a monster down there, I'll handle it. But you got to go down there and face it." You know how much time I spend in the dark now? I've been a police chaplain for 23 years, assigned to a SWAT team. We train from 6 to 2 a.m. We train in abandoned buildings. I'm the bad guy. I've been hiding in dark, abandoned buildings for 23 years from a SWAT team. Before my eyes started failing, I'd go an entire deer season, not cut my light on in the woods. Walk in the dark, walk out in the dark. Dark's not an issue with me. I'm very, very good friends with the dark. And it starts when my dad said, "I'm going to encourage you. I'm not going to take away your responsibility. I'm not going to mock you or demean you, but I'm going to provide you an opportunity to do the thing that you're capable of doing, and I'm going to infuse you with courage." Sometimes being a good parent is simply giving your children the courage to step outside their comfort zone and to do things they would not do without your motivation. Questions, comments? Everybody good? You need a break? Anybody need water, bathroom? Because we can take a break if you need to. If not, we'll soldier on. Going once. I know the mind can only absorb what the seat can endure. All right, so first parental function is to encourage. Second parental function is to comfort. Comfort is the idea of this Greek word that means literally to give counsel or to give advice. We talk about this with crisis intervention. It is to stimulate to the discharge of the ordinary duties of life. Sometimes we get into these situations and we think that whatever drama's going on with us, we have to quit. Well, no. Just because you have a crisis, just because you have a difficulty, just because you have a drama or a trauma, doesn't mean you get to check out of life. There are people who have a hard time. They live every day. So comforting is the idea of giving counsel and advice and to help them discharge the ordinary duties of their life. Basically, it deals with dealing with understanding the mind and the world of a child, and it deals with basically how you deal with crisis intervention. Interesting thing about crisis intervention and understanding is that a lot of that deals with the perception of the kiddo. This is kind of behavioral modification therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy 101. For everything that happens in your life or the life of a child, anything that you could consider an event, for every event that happens, you're going to have a byproduct. No matter what it is, whatever event there is, you get a byproduct, and that byproduct is your emotions. Let's talk about emotions. What are your emotions?
Things that govern your thoughts and feelings.
Things that affect your thoughts and your feelings. Where do your emotions come from? Ultimately, where do they come from? The factory. They're installed. You get the software package to emote from God. My wife says, emote's not a word. It is, trust me. Okay? You have the ability to have emotions because those emotions come from God, and therefore they are all valid. Now, very carefully when you're dealing with your kids, you can't be emotion dismissing or emotion disapproving. You don't look at a child and say, oh, you don't really feel that way. You look at, big boys don't cry. You can't be emotion disapproving. You can't be emotion dismissing. One of the interesting things you have to do with your children is teach them that your emotions are not instructions. Your emotions are information. What's the difference between information and instruction? Information tells you something. Instructions tell you to do something. So you're walking down the mall and you see a yellow placard on the floor. It says wet floor. Is that information or instruction? It's information. If you wet the floor, they'll ask you to leave the mall. Paul Blart will show up and he will escort you right out the door. Wet floor? Well, okay then. No. That is not instruction. That's information. Now, does that information lead to instruction? Yeah. Turn around, stop, slow down, go back, belly slide, whatever you need to do with a wet floor. But we've got to learn that the emotions are valid and they simply tell us something. They don't tell us to do something. And a lot of kids only live in the emotional part of their brain prior to the age of about 6. It's all emotion and concrete thinking. At teenagers, it's all emotion and hormones. And so when I start dealing with people, there's an event, whatever that event was, they're going to process some emotions. If those emotions lead to balance and harmony, I don't really worry about it. If you're grieving and you've got a reason to grieve, there's a grieving process, you'll ride the roller coaster, you'll come out on the other end of it. If you're angry and you express that anger appropriately, you'll cleanse your system, you'll cry, you'll yell, and you'll be all right. Now you start breaking walls or kicking out windows or doing some things. If I see the emotions and they don't produce balance and harmony, in fact, if I see emotions that produce destruction or dysfunction, that's when it becomes a clinical concern. You know, somebody comes into my counseling practice and says, hey, my spouse left me, my dog died, and I lost my job. I think I'm depressed. I go, duh. You're supposed to be depressed. If those things happen and you're not depressed, you're psychotic. Okay? Because you have emotions and things. But now, if that depression lasts 6 months, and my dog died and it was my fault, and I can't get past that, now we've got, because anytime your emotions produce destruction or dysfunction, your emotions aren't doing what they're supposed to do. Godly sorrow works repentance that leads to salvation, not to be regretted. That's from the Bible. If you feel guilty and that guilt produces a change of behavior, guilt's done its job. Now, if you feel guilty and it leads you to withdraw or to self-destruct, guilt's not doing what guilt's supposed to do. The night that Jesus was crucified or arrested and subsequently crucified, one of the 12 apostles admitted knowing him. Which one was it? One guy out of all 12 said, hey, I know Jesus. Judas. Oh, wow, the bad guy. Have the conversation between Peter and Judas. Peter looks at Judas and says, I can't believe you told those guys you knew Jesus. Judas says, I can't believe you told those guys you didn't. Who's worse? Peter repents, weeps bitterly, preaches the first gospel sermon, and Judas goes out and kills himself. Same emotion, guilt, produces a change in Peter, produces destruction and dysfunction in Judas. So when I run into my kids or run into a client or run into my spouse and there's an event and then I see the subsequent emotions, if I see destruction or dysfunction, what I start trying to understand is this wonderful little filter called the perception filter. Because what you perceive
has more effect on what you see than what you see has on what you perceive. One more time for the Kentucky people. What you see, I usually use a different team, but I realize where I'm at. What you see has more effect on what you perceive has more effect on what you see than what you see has on what you perceive. Nobody who doesn't believe in Bigfoot has ever seen him. You realize that, right? I don't believe in Bigfoot. What'd you see, a bear? I don't believe in Bigfoot. What'd you see, a guy in a gorilla suit? I don't believe in Bigfoot. What'd you see, my wife's mother? Whatever. You see what you want to see. But I believe in Bigfoot. What'd you see, Bigfoot? Well, it could have been a chimpanzee, an orangutan, or a shaggy groundhog, and you saw Bigfoot because your perceptions affect that. You guys remember the story of Joseph? Joseph? His father gave him a coat of many colors, a richly ornamented robe, or a coat with sleeves. One of those three translations means he's the heir apparent. He gets this coat, it means I get the stuff. How does Joseph handle his newfound power? He's a jerk, right? He tells his brothers, Dad likes me more than you, I'm going to get the stuff. And I had a dream, and you had stuff, and I had stuff, and your stuff bowed to my stuff. I'm the man. And he tells their dad, hey, the guys are slacking off down here in the field. So now he becomes dad's spy. He didn't have to work in the field. He's just kind of like an overlord, walks around and tells these guys. So one day his dad says, go find your brothers in the field, make sure they know what they're doing. So he goes out there and he gets lost. Can't find his brothers. These neighbors say, yeah, I saw your brothers over there. So here he comes over the hill in his robe now. He wears his robe out to the field where his brothers are working like dogs, and he's dressed in his prom clothes. And he goes over the field. What does his brother say? Here comes that dreamer. And then his brothers invent the game Survivor. And they vote him off the island, okay? Now they want to kill him, but one of their brothers says, hey, let's not kill the kid. Let's sell him. So they sell him to the slave traders. Now if you sell your brother and you go home for supper that night, that's awkward, okay? You know, so where's your brother?
We sold him.
What?
We sold him, sir.
What? They sold their brother and went home for supper. What did they tell their dad? They don't tell him a thing. They take his richly ornamented coat, dip it in goat's blood, and hand it to the old guy. They say, you recognize this? He sees the bloody coat and says, this means my son is dead. It means he's been torn by a wild. And by the way, how do you eat a kid out of his coat and not rip the coat up? That's a ninja lion right there. You know, I mean, he just snatched that kid out of that coat. You know, I don't know how that happens. So this means my son is dead. He's torn by a wild animal. And then this is an interesting phrase in Genesis. I will go to my grave mourning. He translated that in Alabama English. He said, I ain't never going to be happy again. If you start at point A and you end up in your grave mourning, you've never been happy since then. Now, he saw the bloody coat and came to that conclusion. Now, by the way, you know how fragile he is based on that? His brothers end up in Egypt in front of Joseph. Now, my take on this is a little different than everybody else's. Joseph's been in Egypt how many years? And nobody's come to look for him. He doesn't know the song and dance story his brothers have told. All he knows is they sold me and Dad never even so much as whispered my name again. He goes from the kid with the cool coat to they didn't even look for me. My dad would have come and gotten me. Well, you've lived in Egypt all this time and ain't heard nothing. And your brothers show up and so you now, they don't recognize you. So you go, hey, you guys got another brother? I think he's asking about himself. I think he wants to know ownership. Will you tell a stranger, yeah, we had a brother, we sold him? They said, yeah, we've got a younger brother named Benjamin. There's a kid named Benjamin? I don't know if Benjamin was born when Joseph was there, if he was just a toddler. It's kind of hard to figure out that timeline. Joseph says, I want to see him. In fact, if I don't see this kid, you'll never see my face again. My theory is that Joseph wants to find this little brother that is from his mother. The only two that she had was him and Benjamin. And when they get there and he plants that cup in his sack and those brothers leave and he sends his posse out there and they say, hey, the kid who's got that cup goes back with us. What have his brother's track record been? Well, they'll let that kid go back. they sold me in a pit. They'll hang this kid in a minute to save their hides. When Benjamin gets back to Egypt, Joseph says, look, I'm your big brother. Those losers cut you loose and fed you to the dogs. We're rich. I think he's rescuing his little brother from these fools. But when he says, I need to see that boy, they go, no, sir, you don't understand. Our dad is fragile. We had a brother that's no more. And if something happens to Benjamin, that old man will have to come apart. He cannot leave his side because that man's life is bound in the life of that boy. Okay? That's where I think this... Now, when he does get Benjamin caught and his big brother shows back up with him and says, look, I want you to take me, but let this boy go. It breaks his heart that his brothers have changed. He kicks everybody out of the room and cries so loud the Pharaoh hears him. He didn't expect these guys to act this way. And when he sees that they've changed and they've become men, he brings them all to Egypt and saves all their lives. But that, I'm chasing a rabbit. The idea is that old man sees that bloody coat, and when he sees that bloody coat, his perceptions cause him to assign a meaning to these events. This means my son is dead. This means I'll never be happy again. This means he's torn by a wild animal. When something happens in the life of your child, the first thing you do is listen more than talk. Hey, tell me, baby, what happened? Now, the interesting thing is, if you assign a valid meaning to these events, you end up with valid emotions, you get balance and harmony. If you assign invalid meanings to these events, you end up with emotions that lead you to destruction or dysfunction. Teaching a child that I'm willing to discover your meanings teaches them that they are significant, teaches them that they matter. Now, in real crisis intervention, tell me what happened. And I want the details. I want all the details. I want to know, then when you figure out what happened, the next thing you ask is, tell me what that means to you. Now, as a therapist, my next step is, does that mean what you think it means? What do you feel? What do you know? And do they overlap? As a parent, I just want to know what it means to you. I may not do any talking at all. That little girl comes home. She's in the seventh grade, and her and a boy have been going together, and they can't go anywhere, but they're still going together. And then all of a sudden, they quit going places they couldn't go in the first place, and now they're not going to places they didn't go. And it makes my head want to explode, but she's brokenhearted. Man, set her down in your chair and say, look, statistically, you'll be in 8 major relationships before you're married. 60% of you will be engaged one time before you're married. This guy's a loser, 7 to go, all right? Just... right? That's the truth. Is that what she needs to hear? What she needs to hear is, Daddy understands your heart's broke. Daddy understands you're lost. Daddy understands you feel rejected. Sit in my lap and let's cry about it. And let's go get chocolate. That's all she needs to hear. She doesn't need me to fix anything. Crisis intervention is less about fixing and more about listening. Because when you let them know that I have attuned to you, that I see the world through your eyes, I'm not validating it. I'm not saying it's rational. I'm not even saying it's reasonable. I'm just saying I know what this means to you. It doesn't mean that to me, but I know what it means to you, and I'm on the same page. When you do that with crisis intervention, kids oftentimes don't want you solving their problems. They want you attuning to their feelings. And gentlemen, your wives want that too. They don't necessarily need you to fix anything. They just want you to, they just want to be listened to. Do you remember the story of Lazarus, John chapter 11? If you have a Bible, look at John 11. This is one of those cool things. In John 11, and this, my grandmother calls this beating a dead horse or chasing the devil around the stump. She had some weird expression. She also had an expression, said it looked like death eating a biscuit. I have never understood. Apparently, you're very, very ugly if it's death eating a biscuit. But I just anyway. Now, a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was sick. The sisters sent a message to Jesus. Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. And Jesus said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Do you think that's a hint that Jesus knows how this story's going to end? Is this a spoiler alert on Netflix? How many people think this is a hint that Jesus knows what's going to happen here? All right, keep reading. Jesus stayed two more days where he was. Then after that, he said to disciples, we're going to go to Judea again. Verse 11. These things he said, and after he said them, he said, our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up. You think Jesus knows how this story's going to end? Absolutely. The disciples said, Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get well. However, Jesus spoke of his death. They thought he was speaking of taking rest and sleep. So Jesus plainly said to them, Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. Let's go to him. Does Jesus know how this story is going to end? Without a doubt. John chapter 11, verse 20. Now Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went out and met him, left Mary sitting in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. Jesus said to her, verse 23, your brother will rise again. I know my brother will rise again in the resurrection. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection. You understand that I believe there's six or seven instances in this chapter where Jesus says, I know how this story ends. I'm going to go to Bethany and bust that funeral wide open. That's not what it says in Greek. That's in Alabama. But he knows how this story's going to end. Explain then John 11, 35. Jesus wept. What's up with that? Oh, Jesus is weeping for the lack of faith in the condition of the Jews. Please. These people are hurting. He hurt with them. Even though he knew it was all going to be okay, he could cry because they were crying. Please understand that the ability to cry with your children or your spouse or to acknowledge that they're afraid or they're hurt or they're scared or they're disappointed or they're angry is okay. When you deal with crisis intervention with especially your children, what they need to know is, number one, you understand them, and number two, you care about how they feel. And when you minimize their feelings and you minimize the little things, you'll never hear about the big things. And if you can't wrap your mind around the fact that they're heartbroken because they're not going anywhere where they didn't go in the first place, or he didn't make the basketball team, or they lost that little league game, if you can't let them know you get on the same page with them in a compassion way, you won't get much chance at crisis intervention because they won't share the big stuff with you unless you get on the same page with them with the little stuff. Now, please understand, when you're dealing with teenagers, they have daily crisis because they're wired that way. It's the way the little poor little minds work. In my world, that wall is ideal. That wall is unacceptable. If I'm in the room, I'm a happy little ball guy. If you're a teenager, you separate ideal and unacceptable about as narrow as that back cover of my Bible. If I didn't do it all, I can't do any. If I didn't do this, you've never let me do anything. If you didn't let me go there, you've never let me go anywhere. If she doesn't love me, I'll never have a girlfriend again. And they go from absolute wonderful to absolute misery, and it takes about a degree in temperature for that thing to take place. And you got to understand, your teenagers have emotional dysregulation. They see the world in absolute black, absolute white, nothing in the middle. And little bitty kids do it the same way. And rather than try to explain that to them logically, hey, what happened? Okay. What does this mean to you? And explain it back to them. Oh, I get the fact that they didn't ask you to go and you feel like they're not really your friends. Wow. Now, at some point, it's okay to go, does it really mean that? But I'm afraid we jump into that therapy stage way too early. First thing your kids need is compassion. First kid your spouse needs is compassion. Compassion means to suffer with. Calm meaning with. Passios means to suffer. And just learn to get on the same page with folks when they're going through crisis. And then if it's a real significant, serious crisis, you can start doing some of that therapeutic stuff. Does this mean what you think it means? How does not making the baseball team make you an eternal loser? How does the fact that you didn't get chosen for that mean you're not worth it? You can confront what do you feel, what do you know, but that's a later step. Learning to get on the same page and see the world from their world is a good skill for crisis intervention with your kids. And then, so many times parenting is pretty simple. It's about breakups and ball games and losing games. But, you know, when somebody dies or a real trauma happens, you start with, hey, what does this mean to you? And then you can go into, does this mean what you think it means as it's appropriate? Does that make sense? Pretty practical stuff. One of my wife's favorite stories that she tells on me is when our daughter was real little, she had nightmares about tigers. I guess it's the whole Shere Khan thing. I don't know, you know. I guess if you've got a tiger with a British accent, you're super scary to a three-year-old. But, you know, she'd wake up in the night yelling, tigers, you know. And I'd run in her room, and oddly enough, there's no tigers in there. And we videotaped the room, and there are no tigers in here, baby. Well, Dad, they're invisible tigers. And so she had this real, you know, issue with tigers. So underneath our kitchen sink is this yellow aerosol can, P-L-E-D-G-E. That spells tiger spray. And smells like lemons. And you take it into the room, you spray the bed, you spray the curtains, you spray the closet, and the tigers go away. It works on bad dreams and monsters. It's really cool stuff. And one day, Lonnie Beth is about five. She goes, Dad, P-L-E-D-G-E does not spell tiger spray. I said, well, it only works on invisible tigers. Sometimes as a parent, and sometimes as a spouse, you have to deal with invisible tigers. You don't want to walk into somebody else's delusion. You don't want to exacerbate OCD rituals. I'm talking under the bell curve. Sometimes you have to pretend you can see the invisible tigers and do something to make them go away. That's crisis intervention. Everybody good with that? Any questions or comments about this little event meaning emotion chart? Any questions about crisis intervention in general? Teenagers' brains are developing at a rate that is astronomical. The adults in this room have about 300 billion dendrites. That's about the number of observable stars in the galaxy. The average teenager has two or three times that many. Their brains are developing at a rate that's the only time their brains ever develop this fast is when they're two. A two-year-old brain begins to develop at a rapid pace. A teenager is a two-year-old that can drive and has sex hormones, okay? Just so you know what you're dealing with. So when teenagers start doing that, the intellectual part of their mind and the emotional part of their mind for the first time in their lives can communicate. And so a teenager can think and upset themselves. It's really, really a cool thing. And so they go from on and off and to all or nothing. And the one minute they're happy and the next minute, you know, the amygdala is developed and it is hypersensitive and it's larger than it'll ever be any time in their life. So a teenager perceives 90% of their world as a threat. Your amygdala is your threat receptor. People get caught in post-traumatic stress is because they're in an amygdalic loop. And so they see a lot of things as threatening. So a teenager sees a lot of stuff as threat. If I don't have the right shirt, I'm at threat. If I don't have the right shoes, I'm at threat. If I don't have the right haircut, I'm at threat. If I don't have a cell phone with enough technology to launch a space shuttle, I'm at threat. So everything puts them at threat. And so you're sitting at the house, you go, could you pass the salt? Oh yeah, you can't do anything for yourself. Next time, oh, you make me paint the house. You know, like I just needed some salt, you know. But everything that happens in their world seems to be threatening. And because they feel threatened, they respond with confrontation. So that's why you get this heightened sense of with a kid. Because you say something to them, it's absolutely benign, and their response is and it's that fight or flight response. And so 90% of what they do at school is confrontation. They learn to smack talk and oh yeah, and one up each other, and it's the food chain of popularity in school. And so what they've used as a survival skill at home, at school, they use it as a survival skill at home, and we tend as parents to take it personally. You got to realize they're teens, and that's just the way their minds are wired. Now, you may have to have some rules of engagement that this is respect, and this is how we define respect in our house. Yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. Anything else is open to my interpretation. Because a teenager doesn't realize they're being disrespectful to you when they talk to you like they talk to their peers. If a teenager talks to you like they do their peers, that's technically a compliment. But when they do it, it sounds really disrespectful to you. A teenager doesn't realize that non-compliance, that assertion of that independence, sounds really more like defiance to me. And I have to teach them non-compliance equals defiance to an adult. And so just learning in crisis intervention with teenagers is their world is about crisis because of that developmental level of their brain, and that it's much more emotional, and it's emotion with a hormone hurricane going on in there. And so you're going to see a lot of weird crisis with teenagers that when they're younger, you don't see them, and as they mature, you won't see as much. But that 13 to 17 thing, you know, closest thing I can, that's demon possession. But it's fun demon possession, but it's there. Yes, sir. That takes horse sense, you know, and you know whether or not you've got a con man or a car salesman in your house. And, you know, because some kids are, you know, legitimately afraid, and some kids are legitimately, you know, and that's all human behavior is reward motivated. I do what I do because it gets me something I want. That makes sense? Okay. When my behavior costs me more than it costs you, I reevaluate my behavior. So if you feel like you're being manipulated with the monsters, then it may be, you know, since you're afraid of those monsters in your room at night, you can't go spend the night with Susie. Because I'm not sure her dad knows how to deal with those monsters as well as I do. Well, no, I'm cool at Susie's house. It's monster free. Oh, really? And so it may be that you just, you know, keep them consistent across the board. You know, if there's only monsters when they don't want to go to sleep, and there's no monsters when they do, you know, you've got enough savvy and you spend enough ground time with your kid that I think you have enough discernment to know when it's a legitimate fear or when it's a con game. Does that make sense? And walking that balance is, you know, I'm compassionate to a degree, and then if they're, I feel like I can tell when it's a song and dance. I'm not sure I can describe how I can tell that, but I feel like I can tell. I had a kid in my youth group one time. I said, I can tell when you're lying. He says, how can you tell? I said, your lips are moving. But I'm not sure that's a line you want to use with your own child. How old are you talking about? Oh, yeah. I think at that point, you just got to deal with the monsters because I don't think they're sophisticated enough yet. To know that they're, now it may be that they realize if I talk about monsters, I get more FaceTime with dad, and therefore I can use this and dad will stay in here. That's the same, I'm thirsty. I need another story. You know, that's a, I want your undivided attention, and I don't want to go to sleep. And so at that point when it's not a real crisis, it's just a delaying technique, I think you have to be honest, say, look, I think you know that when you tell me you think there's a monster, it's a get out of jail free card. We've dealt with it. I'm going to bed. You'll be all right.
And it's
oh, you're done. Yeah, I'm trying to go to bed. I got to go to work tomorrow. Yeah. You've got to be firm with compassion, not the hostile side of things, but the love side of things. And so you go, you know, I've been in here. You know, do you need to sleep in another room? I need to sleep in your room. No, I said another room. Not my room, but not your room. If you think the monsters are in here, we'll go sleep in the basement. No, I think I'll stay here. You know. And so I think at that point, you know, you do have to set a limit. But you get, you know, they're your children, so you get to decide what your end point is. I don't get to decide that for you because your children are a combination of your personality and your spouse's personality and probably one of your parents. Because my daughter's a lot like my wife's mom. It's really funny. But so you get to use that discernment. I don't think there's a hard and fast answer for that. You know, what will it hurt you to stay another time? And I guess that's what I learned in maturity, is that, you know, I'm going to have one opportunity for her to be four. And with all the crap that comes with it, she won't be four but one time. And if I go to work tired, or I go to work hungry, because I gave her an extra 10 minutes of my bedtime, I don't think I'll ever regret that. I don't think ever in my life will I regret that. And I didn't learn that till she was a little older. And so in my world, you know, I'll be conned to let my daughter know she's important. And, you know, as long as I have informed consent, I'm falling for a con game, but you're never going to be able to say, hey, Dad didn't care about me. But that's me, and I'm a sucker. Can't wait till I have grandkids. I'm going to be worthless. It'd be awesome. They're going to call me Red Bull, because when they come to my house, that's what we're going to drink. It'll be great. They're going to tell their mom, I want to go see Red Bull. Oh, yeah, here we go. And so I'm just saying, I keep telling her I need minions, and they're not cooperating yet. But when I get minions, I will be Red Bull. It'll be great. Anything else? All right, let's look at some. You guys need a break or anything? What? Okay, let's take a short break. Maybe 10 minutes. Bathrooms on both sides. Water bottles there.